We're ready to go for our North Canton webcast Bible study here this evening. I'm Randy Stiver, pastor here as well as in Youngstown, Ohio, Pittsburgh, and Pennsylvania, Wheeling, West Virginia. Before we get underway with our Bible study, we're going to ask God's inspiration, so if you'll bow your heads. Our Heavenly Father, we thank you for the blessing and the opportunity to be able to sit down as the Sabbath is getting close to us here and wind our minds down and our bodies down from the busyness of the week to be ready for the spiritual and the physical rest that comes with the Sabbath. And to help with that, we are going to be able to have a Bible study. We pray that you'll bless all of our electronic equipment that'll make sure that it goes out clearly and everybody can receive it at their homes just as clear as can be. We pray, though, Father, in particular for two aspects of inspiration. First on the teaching, second on the understanding and comprehension of what we're going to study in your word. And we do thank you for the knowledge of your truth. It's what pulls us together, and we will be going over some of that. We ask your inspirational aspects in Jesus Christ's name. Amen. Okay. Well, we're ready to get into the topic. And this is a topic as it came up to us this past week in monitoring a social media discussion where there were some young adults in the church who didn't understand the connection of Assyria in the Bible with the modern nation state of Germany, or rather of the German people, and actually German and the Austrians. So they didn't see that it was important, mainly because they didn't have the background and the knowledge of that. And that got me to thinking that probably a lot of us haven't really stopped to look at that aspect of both history and prophecy in the Bible. So the title is for this evening is Assyria in Bible History and Prophecy. Assyria's got two S's, by the way. A-S-S-Y-R-I-A. Assyria in Bible History and Prophecy. So we'll look at the historical aspects and how we follow where Assyria went, where it was and where it went, and then go all the way up to dynamics that are coming up ahead of us at the end of this age and then into the world tomorrow before we get to the conclusion. The Church of God has long connected ancient Assyria, the empire that took the lost 10 tribes of Israel captive. In 720 BC was the last wave of that captivity, with the Assyrian Empire took all the 10 tribes into captivity. And we'll be looking at the ancient Assyria and comparing it and see how it's connected with modern-day Germany, because in fact it is. Ancient tribes have grown into nations. And we can track the tribes of Israel, and we know which nations, in most cases, they have turned into, and or groupings of nations, as in, for example, the British nations are the tribe of Ephraim. America is descended from the tribe of Manasseh. Now, an interesting sidelight in that is that you have the dominant tribe that is now the national core of the population, but that doesn't mean everybody who lives here is a Manassite. America, frankly, has a great deal of the tribe of Dan inserted into it and with the Irish migrations of the mid-1800s. And I don't mean the Scots-Irish. Those were probably all Manassites, the Scots-Irish. But the Irish-Irish that came around the time of the American Civil War between the early 1840s to just after the American Civil War was the very, very large migration having to do with the Irish potato famines that were going on and them leaving to come to America, a land of opportunity. So there's an awful lot of Dan mixed into Manasseh, a lot of Judah and Benjamin and Levi, which are where the Jewish peoples come in, are mixed in. But you see, here we are tossing out ancient tribal names and routinely talking about who they are today. Now, many of us in God's church have in the backs of our minds who those nations were and how we can come to know that. But we haven't gone over one of the most dynamic of all the non-Israelite nations, which would be a Gentile nation in that sense. By the way, Gentile is not a pejorative word. All it means is nations. The Hebrew version, the Hebrew word is goyim, spelled in English letters G-O-Y-I-M. When you have the I-M on the end of a Hebrew word, it's like putting an S on the end of it in English. So it means nations. So you have the nation being Israel, looking at the 10 tribes combined in ancient times, and everybody else are the nations, the nation and the nations. Now we're going to look, though, at Assyria and see how it is connected with the German nation. In 1870, the German states, 1870-80, a century and a half ago, the German states organized together into the German Reich. Reich means in German kingdom, and it became an empire. Quite frankly, they went out and had colonies in Africa and other places, trying to compete with the English primarily and to a certain degree with the French. And in the 1900s, Germany fought two world wars, and they pretty much were against everybody else for the most part. You know, granted, World War II, they were technically allies of Japan, not that they probably ever saw each other because they were on the opposite sides of the globe, but they were fighting Russia and the United States and the rest of Europe. It was one medium-sized nation, geographically, taking on virtually all the world, not once, but twice in the same century. Now, they lost both times, but the fact that they would, 20 years after the first one ended, start another one, it shows something about the moxie, the Assyrians of the past and the modern-day Germans have. It's quite remarkable. Now, as things went on, and be reminded of some of the events over the past few decades, within 20 years, less than 20 years, after their defeat in World War II, Germany was leading what became known as the European Common Market. Later, that was changed to the European Economic Union, the EEU, as we call it today. And then finally, as the communist regime of East Germany, remember, at the end of World War II, West Germany was a free nation and thus under the America, England's, and the rest of the Allies' control until West Germany could operate on its own, which didn't take very long. But East Germany was in the Soviet bloc and therefore under communist control until 1989. That's when communism started to have a meltdown. And so within a very short time, then Germany was united again. It's a remarkable nation with comeback qualities that are just amazing. For over 1,000 years, Germany has claimed the status of the bulwark of the European civilization. The first city founded in Europe was Trier. We'll get into that a little bit more later. On her western border, the first city, to our knowledge, in the world. Or rather, in history, that was founded in Europe. And it was founded by ancient Assyrians. She held sway, Germany did, for centuries as the Europeans' eastern defense against the barbarians of Asia. And that would have included some of the Hunnic invaders, although many of the Huns melded into the greater German sphere of influence in Hungary, and perhaps even in Germany and Austria to a certain degree. And bear in mind, Germany and Austria really are the same major peoples. It's not just a single nation with dotted line around it for a border. It's actually a grouping of nations and peoples that have been labeled as German over the years. The German Reich, or kingdom, endured as the oldest European political institution, older even than anything France or England had, ruling for over 1,000 years. She called herself, for most of that time, the Holy Roman Empire, picking up where the Romans left off, in a sense. This Holy Roman Empire of the German people was officially designated by the Church in the Middle Ages, meaning the Roman Catholic Church, in the Middle Ages as the Kingdom of God on Earth. That's what they called Das Himmelreich. That's Das Römische Himmelreich. The Holy Roman Empire was the Kingdom of God on Earth by the Roman Church. Its citizens, the Germans, felt themselves true Romans and bearers of the Christian Reich, or kingdom. They were therefore the chosen people of the Christian era, entrusted with a world mission to be the protectors of Christianity. Now, that paragraph was written by Dr. Herman Hay in a Plain Truth magazine in 1962. And I just thought it was a very good summary of that aspect of it. The German leaders and philosophers have never forgotten this notion of the Middle Ages, that the German, in place of the Jew, has a special mission from God. German politicians know that their dream of world empire can be created only if they maintain this claim of world mission. So it's really a fascinating study to see the great focus that the German people have had and the accomplishments that they've had. I'll get into those, just to hear it for a second. Germany has been the center of learning for generations, great universities there. German inventions have been amazing, including mass communications. Before there was an internet, there was a printing press, the Gutenberg printing press in the 1500s. Most of the world's renowned musicians came out of Germany. Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, Handel, Haydn, Mozart, Schumann, Schubert, the Strasses, and Wagner, just to name a few. A remarkable number. German inventions have contributed greatly to the modern world, modern industrial world. Daimler invented the motorcycle, gasoline-driven automobile. Rudolf Diesel invented the diesel engine. And then words that we have for things are actually the names of the German inventors. Siemens invented this furnace for steelmaking. Bayer, the synthesis of chemical dyes. Fahrenheit, that was his name, gave us the mercury thermometer. Benz, otherwise known as Mercedes-Benz. Benz gave us the internal combustion engine. Mitterhofer, the typewriter. Rongren discovered the X-ray. And who hasn't read some of Grimm's fairy tales translated into whatever language, certainly into English? And those were written by the brothers Grimm, who were, you know, classified as Germans. They just have been a remarkably productive nation in that sense. But where is Germany in the Bible? That's the question we want to know. Many lesser nations than Germany, smaller, less dynamic in the modern era, have been mentioned by name in the Bible. Germany, however, is not ignored. In fact, there are dozens of prophecies referring to Germany. We'll just touch on a few. But you'll be able to then go and see where the rest of them are on your own study. She's usually referred to by the name of a primary ancestor. For example, in Genesis 19, I think I have that marked here in my Bible. In Genesis 19, and it's verses 37 and 38 of Genesis 19, talks about Moab and Ammon. Here we go. Let's just read that real quickly. The firstborn bore a son, and these are the daughters of Lot, having the son in the situation after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. You may remember that story that's earlier in the chapter. With a child by their father, the firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He's the father of the Moabites today. And the younger, she bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi. And he is the father of the people of Ammon, named after the last part of his name, Ammi, to this day. Moab and Ammon, we know, is the modern nation state of Jordan. Those are the primary peoples who live there. That's where their territories were. They were one of the few nations in the world that haven't migrated someplace or another over the years. They've pretty much been where they are. But they're mentioned by name, so we know Jordan is in the Bible. Tarshish was the biblical name of Spain's ancestor. If you go back to chapter 10 of Genesis, a page or two back here, notice several things in chapter 10, verse 4, for example. The sons of Javan were Elisha, Tarshish, Kittim, and Dodanim. Dodanim. There we go. I did say it right the first time. Tarshish. That was the name for Spain. In Solomon's day, he had a fleet of the ships of Tarshish. I don't know that the ancient Spaniards built them, but they sailed past Spain. They went past Tarshish. Tarshish was also a city in Spain. So that's the name of the Spaniards. Maybe not all of the Spaniards. There are ethnic groups that blend into various nations. In verse 2 of the same chapter, the sons of Japheth were Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshach, and Tiras. So we have Meshach and Tubal mentioned in that list. Meshach and Tubal are ancestors of many of the modern-day Russians and ended up in that part of the world eventually. Egypt is mentioned by name. Ethiopia is mentioned by name. Greece is. Persia is. And they're referred to by their modern names. And when I say, well, Persia is not, it's called Iran. Well, it was only called Iran after the Ayatollah Khomeini took over the nation from the Shah of Iran, Shah of Persia. Iran and Persia were the two names, but Persia was certainly and is recognized as one of the names for it. So we need to know, we want to then look at Germany's role in modern history, and I've got a very interesting statement here that alludes to some of the things I mentioned about the German inventors and so on. This is from a book called The History of Germany by Bayard Taylor some years back. The history of Germany is not a history of the nation, but of a race. Thus, even before the fall of the Roman Empire, it becomes the main trunk out of which branches the histories of nearly all European nations and the connecting link between ancient and modern history. The records of no other race throw so much light on the development of civilized lands during a period of 1,500 years. That's from a book called The History of Germany by Taylor. So Germany was a hinge-pin nation in Europe, very significant. Yet it isn't mentioned as Germany in the Bible. However, it's not overlooked in the scriptures. There are many tribes in the scriptures, and this is how we reason through and make this connection between Germany and Assyria. For example, we know that the nation of Israel was the name of Jacob, his other name. It was Abraham was his grandfather, Isaac was his father, and then Jacob was the one through whom the birthright, the blessing that God had given to be the father of the chosen nation would come, through Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. Jacob, as I mentioned, his name was changed to Israel. So Jacob or Israel are interchangeably used. But when you talk about the nation, you don't talk about the nation of Jacob. You talk about the nation of Israel. The nation of Israel had 12 tribes that made up its population in the ancient world. They were the names. They were named after each of the 12 sons of Jacob. So that's where Ephraim and Manasseh came from. Actually, they were grandsons. Their father's name was Joseph. And Joseph received the birthright from the patriarch Jacob, which meant that he got twice as much of the estate and of the promises that God was giving than all the other tribes, twice as much as any of the other tribes. And that we meant that, in fact, his tribe became two tribes, named after each of his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. So that gives us an inkling there where Israel had that. Germany came from numerous tribes as well, and tribes that are mentioned in the Bible. Now, we know of one tribe of Germans, in America at least, that affected American history. They were called the Hessians. They were hired soldiers, hired from that part of Germany, or Hesse, I believe it was called, in Germany. And they served as mercenaries for the British in the U.S. Revolutionary War. In fact, one of the critical victories of General Washington's campaign in the Revolution was to capture the Hessian soldiers at Trent, and he did. He pulled off an amazing coup as far as capturing a huge section. As it turned out, then a few of the Hessians ended up fighting for America rather than against America, and some settled here, but most went home. The Hessians, though, were Germans. At the time of Christ, the Germans migrated into Europe and then were known to the Romans by their tribal names. The tribal names of some of these we will see in the Bible. One, the Hatti, H-A-T-T-I in English letters. The Hatti also known as Hittites, another name for that, were the ancestors of the Hessians. The Alemanni is another grouping that were coming into the territory that became Germany. The Suebi, Suabi or Suebi, I'm quite sure is interchangeable with Suabia, which is in southern Germany. You have the Quadi, as the Romans would call them. These are all Roman versions of their names. And the Cassari, and a few others. Those are just a sampling of some of the various tribes that ultimately made up the German and Austrian nations. The Romans had a collective name for them. They called them the Germani, or the Germani, depending on how they said a J, or the G sound, rather. Smith's Classical Dictionary states this: there can be no doubt that they migrated into Europe from the Caucasus and the countries around the Black and Caspian Seas. That's how the Germani came into Europe, coming around the Caucasus, which is a range of mountains that stretches between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. Now, there were other people that came along with them, in fact, and this complicates it a little, but not a lot. The tribes of Israel came too. Bear in mind, the Assyrians took the Israelite tribes captive. The Israelite tribes helped to bring down, ultimately, the Assyrian Empire. Within about 100 years after their captivity, give or take, they were involved in the collapse of it. Then they were free to begin making their own way as tribes and clans, and they started their migrations in various directions, and that's a whole nother study where the tribes of Israel went. But many of them came into Europe over the Black Sea with the Germans or the Germani, and they were called Germani as well. So they were all lumped in together. Sometimes they were called Goti or the Goths. That included Israelites and what we would call Germans, modern-day Germans at that time, at different times. So that gives us some indication of where the movement came in. I study the tribes, the movements of the tribes of Israel, and we'll have Bible studies on those sometime along the way. But let's get back to the Assyrians as they moved under the name, the Roman name of the Germani, and we'll look at what that meant. It means war men. They were war men. They were fighters. So the Romans kind of named things for what they were. They had to fight with these guys all the time, and they were good fighters. They got beat by them on numerous occasions. In fact, one of the worst occasions for the Romans was about 378 A.D., they were beat by a Goth army that was smaller than the Eastern Empire. By that time, Rome had the front, the Eastern and Western half. Well, this was the Eastern half, and they were destroyed. Most of their army was destroyed by a smaller army of Goths, or Goti, as they would call them. Whether they had some Germans mixed in is unclear, because a lot of those were actually elements of the various tribes of Israel. But they had lived together on and off from 720 BC, and so by the time they start in and really begin to incur into the Roman Empire was about 800 to 1,000 years later, in the later years of the Roman Empire. Remember, Rome collapsed in 476, so it was in the 300s. That they really had a lot to do with these, and a little bit earlier than that, but mainly the 300s and into the 400s. The oldest European and German city is Trier. I mentioned that earlier. It was founded 2,000 years before Christ by, this is what historical traditions say, by Trebetta. Trebetta, T-R-E-B-E-T-A, was a son of the famous Assyrian king Ninus. Ninus is the Assyrian way of saying Nimrod. Now, this wasn't Nimrod, but this was another one who wasn't called Nimrod. In fact, one finds in the Trier inscription, reading in Trier, there's an inscription reading that Trier existed 1,300 years before Rome was rebuilt. So it goes very, very far back, in time. And most of us don't stop to think that there could have been colonization deep into Europe from the Middle East at a very early time. but yes, there could. The evolutionary thinking of our modern world makes you think that people drag their knuckles and couldn't make decisions before noon, and therefore they didn't progress anywhere. They just kind of hung around where they were for the longest time. Not the case. They knew how to make boats. They could go across seas. They knew how to make wagons. They knew how to make all kinds of things. And they were intelligent human beings. Evolution doesn't think that. Evolution is lost in a cloud of understanding. They don't know what they're talking about. Don't ever let that influence your understanding or appreciation of history. Now, here's some evidence of the migration of the Asherites or the Assyrians. About 400 AD, this would be the time that Rome is in definite decline and headed down to cessation of existence, and then it would have to be resurrected as the Holy Roman Empire, and those were all prophesied in the Bible in another place we probably won't have time to go through today, but in Daniel and Revelation, two different places. About 400 AD, Jerome was famous for translating the Bible into Latin. Irritated the Roman church at the time because he did his own translating. He was not influenced by so much by dogma of the Roman Church. Somewhat, but not much. And when the Indo-Germanic tribes were invading the Roman Empire was the time that he was working, you know, he was alive. And he made the comment in one of his letters, he said, "For Asher also is joined with them." And he was citing Psalm 83 and verse 8. Let's go back to Psalm 83 and verse 8. This is an interesting psalm. Psalm 83 and verse 8. Find it here in a minute. I have a Band-Aid on the end of my thumb, and I don't turn single pages. I turn many pages at once. And he is quoting from verse 8. Let me read it. The stanza starts, "For they have consulted together with one consent. They form a confederacy against you," the you being God. This is a song of Asaph, probably one of David's trained musicians. The tents of Edom in verse 6 and the Ishmaelites. Ishmaelites are primarily the Arab peoples of today. Edom would be primarily Turkey, the Turks who moved into Asia Minor at a certain time, but they were Edomites. Moab, we know that's part of Jordan, and the Hagrites, Gebal, Ammon, and Amalek, Philistia, and Amalek and Ammon, again, part of the Jordanians, and Gebal probably as well. Amalek and Philistia, the Philistines are Philistia. Philistines were actually Egyptians who left and went up to Greece and founded what became known as the Minoan civilization. And then after the vast earthquake or volcanic explosion or combination, they tried to go back to Egypt. The Egyptians said, "We don't want you to come," essentially. And so you go up the coast and find a new place. So they landed in the southern part of Israel. And that's the Philistines. And the inhabitants of Tyre. Tyre is on the north of the border of Israel along the Mediterranean coast. David had a very close friendship with the king of Tyre, whose name was Hiram in David's day. And Hiram lived on into Solomon's time and provided a lot of the lumber and skilled workmen, constructors and so on, for building Jerusalem and all the things Solomon had there, but particularly helping with the building of the temple in Solomon's day. And then we come to verse 8. "Assyria also has joined with them, and they have helped the children of Lot," Moab and Ammon. So this was a confederation coming against Israel, and they were defeated. But we find that the children of Assyria were involved there, helping the children of Lot. So that's what Jerome quoted. "For Asher is joined with them." Then he quoted part of this psalm in his book the Nicene and post-Nicene fathers. He was a historian of that time, of 400 AD. 300 years before Jerome was the time of Pliny the Elder, who was a Roman naturalist. So this would have been back about 100 AD, about the time the Apostle John was coming to the end of his life, or maybe he had just died. He's a Roman naturalist, and he wrote that the Assyriani were dwelling north of the Black Sea, and from there they migrated, we know, into Europe. So by 100 AD, they had begun to move up the Black Sea coast, which also is where the Scythians were moving. The Scythians were primarily Israelites, but they had lived with the Assyrians for a long time. They knew each other. And so they were making a migration at that time. This is what is called in history Das Völkerwanderung. A German historian came up with that name. Völkerwanderung means the great people wandering. Völkern is people and Wanderung is wandering. So the great people wandering lasted for between 300 and 600 years until the tribes coming out of the Middle East and certain parts of Asia migrated back and forth and up and down and eventually landed where God wanted them to be. He was then pushing the populations into Europe and elsewhere in the world as well, but in particular into Europe. So you had some of the Scythians, who were Israelite elements, traveling all the way over to China, fighting with them until they built a wall and it wasn't fun anymore, and then coming back, staying down in what is now Persia for a time, or Afghanistan, and then in the 200s, early 300s AD, about the time between Pliny and Jerome, they begin to migrate up and land, come across the over the Black Sea, and then down into Europe, trying to get into the Roman Empire. So there's the people moving here and there in great swaths. And the Assyriani were among them. So the Assyrians were on the move up into Europe. 550 BC, this goes back another 150 years, 250, well, no, 600 years or so, before Pliny the Elder, 550 BC, this would have been, Jerusalem was captured by the Babylonians. There was an author named Silex. There aren't many ancient books that have survived. So what historians and archaeologists have found are some. And so they have writings. Those writings are very valuable to give us some insight of the details of life and where people moved at the time back in the day, as we say here in Ohio, back in that day anyway. He wrote Periplus, and he writes of the Black Sea coastal area, quoting, "The coast of the Black Sea is called Assyria." So Assyria initially was further down, but then it is moved up to the Black Sea by 550. That means the Assyrian Empire has begun to collapse, and they're moving, and they're migrating. And in fact, that's what they did. That was from a book quoted him. It was a book about art. Art historians have to know these things so that they will know what art objects they're looking at. Now, Abraham, this is interesting, fought Assyrians at one point. He carried on a rescue mission. Let's go to Genesis chapter 14 and read this short bit of the adventure at least. Chapter 14 and verse 1, "And it came to pass in the days of Aphrael, king of Shinar, that Arioch, king of Elasar, and Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and Birsha, king of Gomorrah, and the other kings in that neighborhood, and they joined together in the valley of Sidon, that is the Salt Sea," that would be the Dead Sea, "and they made the Sodom and Gomorrah and the other surrounding cities their vassal, sort of a vassal territory, where they had to pay tax, they had to recognize the authority of this five-king coalition, or four-king coalition. And then they rebelled down there. They didn't want to do that anymore. So they came down in a punitive expedition. And as they left, they took Lot and his family captive. Now, Lot was the nephew of Abraham. So the rest of the story is that when Abraham found out that Lot had been taken captive, he gathered up some of his hired help, about a small force of 300 people or a little more, and they went after them. They went all the way up through the spine of what was to be known later as the Promised Land or the nation of Israel. And he came to a town called Laish. Laish got to be renamed later. It was called Dan when the Danites went up and conquered it. But at that time, it was a Gentile city. Abraham went through Laish and ultimately caught up with these men and in an adventure in the middle of the night came in and routed their troops, spoiled and took back a great deal of spoil and also rescued Lot, his nephew, and his wife and their daughters and brought them all back home down in southern Israel where they lived. So that was what was beginning here, and the commanders were four. There was Amraphel, Arioch, Chedorlaomer, and Tidal. Now, Josephus, who was a Jewish historian in the early 100s AD, in the modern era, Josephus calls these kings to be kings of Assyria. Not the king of Assyria, but kings of Assyria. In other words, Assyria was made up of kingdoms that work together, united together. Tidal, T-I-D-A-L, is the name of that one, was also an Assyrian name, making the Hatti or Chatti an Assyrian tribe. Because it's, let's see, that the Tidal was an Indo-Germanic name. I'm sorry, the others were Semitic, but it was an Indo-Germanic name, a common throne name among the ancient Chatti or Hatti, also known later as the Hittites of Asia Minor. And that's where the Hittite kingdom was, in southeastern Asia Minor. And sometimes it expanded to where it was all of eastern Asia Minor. Tidal was also an Assyrian name, making the Hatti and Chatti, therefore, an Assyrian tribe. So the Hittite Empire was actually in conjunction with the Assyrian Empire. They were a part of a greater empire together. That's an important understanding because the Hatti are going to eventually end up in Germany, and that was the High German name for them was the Hatti, H-A-T-T-I, or Hatti, and they were also called the Hesse in another dialect, and they were the Hessians or the Hattians. So Tidal is an Assyrian name, making Hatti and Chatti an Assyrian tribe. Tidal was the king of nations and ruled over others besides his own Hatti or Chatti, and therefore they were war men or Germanen, German. And they were known as Germans down there too, in the name for war men, because they were always on expeditions conquering people. Thus, the Hatti and the Chatti were Assyrian migrants who eventually moved into the territory of modern Germany. They became modern Hessians, the Hesse, and High German is pronounced as Hatti instead of Hesse. They drop the S's and they become T's. The capital of Hesse was known by the Romans as Ninus Vetus, which means the old Nineveh. That was their territory in Germany. The Romans called Ninus Vetus, or the old Nineveh, meaning they saw the connection between the Hatti and Assyria's capital, which was Nineveh, down in the Middle East, which is northern Iraq. It's across the river from Mosul, Iraq right now is where the ancient site of Nineveh was. The empire of Hatti and the Assyrian, therefore, empire were the same. They were part of the same. Let's notice this. This would be, the next item is in 1 Kings 10, verse 29. This is kind of a technical study of the Bible, by the way, as you can see. We're going and picking up pieces of data and blending it with other information that we have from historians, getting the information from the scripture and then tying it all together in that sense. 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 29. We'll start in verse 28 because that's where the paragraph begins. And Solomon had horses imported from Egypt and Kiva, and the king's merchants bought them at in Kiva at the current price. Now, verse 29. Now, a chariot that was imported from Egypt cost 600 shekels of silver, and a horse about 150. And thus, through their agents, they exported them to all the kings of the Hittites and the kings of Syria. Now, Syria, or Aram was another name for Syria, was actually where Syria is today. And they are descendants of the Aramaeans. They were a more powerful kingdom at that time, especially than that they are right now. But we noticed that the chariots were being bought, in particular, by the Hatti, or the Hittites. Just a few pages later in 2 Kings, chapter 7, 2 Kings, chapter 7, and verse 6. For the Lord had caused the army of the Syrians to hear the noise of the chariots and the noise of the horses and the noise of a great army. And they said to one another, look, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the kings of the Egyptians to attack us. So the Syrians were spooked by the noise, and they assumed there were a great many more perhaps than there were. And they therefore jumped to the conclusion that Israel was in league with the Assyrians, the Hittites, as well as Egypt. Egypt was a major power in those days, compared to Germany. Egypt isn't the major power that it once was, but it certainly had its day in the sun, many, many days, many centuries and centuries of power on the world scene. But what we get here is the Hittites were a warring nation. They were warmen, or German, German, as they would say. Now, there were other German tribal groupings that we need to be aware of. We have the eastern province in one of the eastern provinces of pre-World War II Germany was Silesia, S-I-L-E-S-I-A, Silesia. And the Hittites, that part of the empire, controlled a territory called Cilicia, spelled in English letters, C-I-L-I-C-I-A. You know that to be the territory of where the Apostle Paul came from in the first century. He was from Saul of Tarsus, which was one of the key towns in Cilicia in Southeast Asia Minor. Well, there's a province that bears the same name, spelled with C versus S versus a C, but it's the same name. Another example, or another detail of this, is that there was a major ancient city in Cilicia, down there in Southeast Asia Minor, would be Eastern Turkey today. That name of that city at that time was called Germanicopolis. Germanicopolis. That would be a Greek name. But the Germani are right there in it. The war men city is what it means. Located in Cilicia. Let's go to chapter 25, because we'll look at a little bit more of the other areas of Germany and the other regions or provinces of Germany and Austria that have ancient names, going back to the time of the Assyrians and the Hittites. Genesis 25, and here we have the death of Abraham. This is a very interesting particular detail about it. Abraham again took a wife. In verse 1, her name was Keturah. So when Sarah died, then he married Keturah, took her as a wife. And she bore him and some sons. So here are the sons' names: Zimran, Jokshan, Medan, Midian. And you think, ooh, Midian. I know Midian, the Midianites. Moses married Zipporah, and her father was a Midianite priest. And exactly right, that was the Midianites. They descended from Midian, Ishbak, and Shua. And then it gives a little of the genealogy of Jokshan, who was the number two son. And Jokshan, in verse 3, begot Sheba and Dedan. Sheba and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were Asherim and Letushim and Lumim. Lumim. Okay, now this is Asher. This is not the Asher that Assyria is named after. They're named after a grandson of Noah. Shem, and there were three sons of Noah, and you can read about this earlier in Genesis, in chapter 10, in fact, of Genesis. There was Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the Assyrians were descended from Shem through Asher, was one of the sons of Shem. And that's where the Assyrians came from. The Israelite came through Shem as well. I don't know if Adolf Hitler knew that the ancient Assyrians were Semites, because he labeled that as only being the Jewish people in his demented thinking back in that time. But in fact, the Assyrians, the Germans, are Semites, just like the Israelites were Semites. So that is an interesting point. Now, getting again here, Jokshan's son, Dedan and Sheba. From Sheba, we can see the name of Swabia, which is a southern section of Germany that borders Switzerland. The Nordic North Germans came from Asherim, the son of Dedan, the son of Jokshan, and the Lettish people along the Baltic Sea from Letushim, again, a son of Dedan. So we find here that part of the line of Abraham was also stirred in with the greater mixture of the Assyrian peoples, or the German peoples, as they were known as German or Germans, as well as Assyrian in the ancient world. But the ancestor of the vast majority of the Germans and as Austrians was Asher. Asher was the son of Shem, who was the son of Noah. That's who the primary ancestor was. These others are the people that ended up being melded into the German kingdom in that sense. Assyrians anciently called their land Atur. Instead of Asher, it was Atur, with A-T-H-U-R. And you think, well, that looks like Arthur. If you put another R up there, it probably is the origin of Arthur, I'm guessing. Atur was shortened simply to Tur in the Indo-Germanic language. In Germany, or ancient Assyria, had two languages. They had their classical study language was Semitic language, but they spoke an Indo-Germanic language. In the Indo-Germanic language, they tended to drop the beginnings, apparently, of words and ended up using the latter part. So Atur for Asher, Atur just simply became Tur, T-Y-R, in the Germanic language. And he was worshipped as the god of war. Now, that makes sense, because the Assyrians became known as the men of war, or the war men, or the Germans. So they worship the god of war. It makes perfect sense. They would be focusing on the god of war. Now, all the nations worship one sort of god of war or another. It's just that they seem to make more of a living at it than most nations. Tur's name was given to the third day of the week. Tuesday. Not Thursday. That's Thor's day. Now, that's another god, but he's a Scandinavian god, named after Thor, the son of Odin, and they were both human people that got elevated to divine status and by the pagan thinking of the time. No, Thursday is where we get Tuesday. In the English, we call it Tuesday, but Tuesday in the Anglo-Saxon, we spell it T-E-U-S-D-A-Y, and the old Anglo-Saxon, it was Tuesday, T-I-W-apostrophe-S-D-A-Y. Tuesday. It was the god of war for the Germanic people of Europe. And since a lot of Israelites, and the Anglo-Saxons were Israelites, migrated with Assyria because they've been taken captive by Assyria, and then they either got free or they became allied with, as the case might be, acclimatized to each other, they moved in large groupings together, in many cases, up into Europe and giving the Romans a lot of grief at the time. The ancient Assyrians knew Asher as Tur or Tu, The European Germans claimed Teu or Tyr, therefore, as their ancestor. When you read their histories, they're claiming Tyr or Teu for Asher as their ancestor. Now you think, yes, but they're called Deutschland, Deutschland über alles. The German's word for German is Deutsch. Where does that come from? Well, it's an old Anglo-Saxon Teutsch. And you're like, what do you mean? Deutsch or Teutsch? Which is it? A D or a T? D's and T's are phonetically interchangeable. If you just do the sound of the T and then do the sound of the D, and you'll find your lips don't move at all. In fact, almost nothing except a little tiny bit of your tongue moves to change the sound from T to D. So they become phonetically interchangeable in many respects. So Deutsch, it can also be Deutsch. Put a T on the front of it. Deutsch in German is the word for German, and it means D-E-U-T-S-C-H. That's the word for Deutsch. Deutschland, you put a land on the end of it, you have Germany and German English in the German language. Therefore, the Deutsch was a son or descendant of Teu or Tyr or Atur or Ashur. You know, when you put the full word in and not just that final syllable. Ancient Hindu literature speaks of Ashuras and Didatas to refer to the Assyrians more than 1,500 years B.C. So it may well be that the Asher and Didatas, the Teu and the Du, the Deutsch and the Teutsch, had a long beginning. It's very, very possible. In language studies, ancient linguistic scholars assumed that Assyria would speak a Semitic language. That's what they assumed as they were studying the Semitic, when they found Nineveh, finally, thanks to the, I believe it was one of the Rawlinson brothers who discovered the site of Nineveh. I might be wrong on that, but it was one of the early archaeologists. Before archaeology was really a serious study, there were a few English and a few other Swiss and German scholars who were doing the groundbreaking, pardon the pun, for archaeology. And they found the site of ancient Nineveh. European linguistic scholars studied the Hessian or Hittite and ancient Western Assyrian language and found that it was Indo-Germanic. And there were various words, in fact, numerous various words, in the Indo-Germanic language that were extremely similar to High German, Old High German. When the descendants of the lost tribes of Israel arrived in Europe, they also spoke an Indo-European language, whereas they had been Semitic. They were Israelites. They were Semites, and so they spoke Hebrew. But when they got into Europe, they didn't speak Hebrew. They spoke an Indo-European language, probably Assyrian language, because that's who had taken them captive. Undoubtedly, they were forced to learn that language while they were in captivity. That captivity began in 335 B.C. with the first wave. It was concluded by 320 B.C., and then they were either working as slaves for or fighting with the German people, then known as the Assyrians. Researchers found when excavating the Assyrian libraries that Semitic was the literary language, that in fact they used two languages. The Semitic language was the literary language of Assyria. And then the Indo-Germanic language was the language that the people popularly spoke. And you think, well, when has that ever happened? Oh, that's easy. In the after the Roman era, Latin was the language of education for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. Almost everything was learned in Latin until relatively more modern times, when some of the nation states began to get it into power and when they began to solidify their own common language, like English became English, unified English, and German and French each unified as what they were. Otherwise, the literary language was Latin at that time. Before that, it was the literary language was Greek. So it's not uncommon to see that very phenomenon that we can see here, looking back where the Assyrians had a Semitic language for literature, and then they had the spoken language, which actually was Indo-European, or Indo-Germanic, as they classify them. Let's look now at a couple of prophecies about Assyria. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 10. And verse 5 of Isaiah 10, just in our last few minutes of the Bible study. This is verse 5 of Isaiah 10. Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hand is my indignation. I will send him against an ungodly nation and against the people of my wrath, and I will give him charge to seize the spoil and take the prey, to tread them down like the mire in the streets. Yet he does not mean so, nor does his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off not a few nations. Isaiah was writing that prophecy just as the Assyrians were beginning to strike the 10 tribes of Israel. Remember, at that time in Isaiah's day, there were two nations of Israel. The southern one was the house of Judah. The northern one was the house of Israel. The 10 tribes up there and the 2 tribes down south. They never did conquer the Jews. They tried to. In 780, they made their final attempt during the time of Hezekiah, and they were defeated. And then they never bothered again. But they took the 10 tribes captive, lock, stock, and barrel, and hauled them off to their empire and repositioned them elsewhere until the Assyrian Empire collapsed under the weight of enemies and internal problems caused partly by the Israelites they'd taken captive. And then the various portions of the Assyrian Empire started to do this wandering thing just like the 10 tribes were doing. So there God calls Assyria the rod of his anger. That was back then. There will be another fulfillment of that as time goes by. We already read a section out of Psalm 83, and how they have consulted together with one consent, verse 5, they formed a confederacy against you, referring to God, the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, and the Moab and the Hagrites, Gebal, Ammon, Amalek, Philistia, and the inhabitants of Tyre, Assyria has also joined them, and they have helped the children of Lot, Selah. So this may have been a war that David fought, but there will be shades of this prophecy being fulfilled again in the end time. You can look at Daniel's head, and this is what throws people sometimes. You see Daniel's image, rather, of Daniel chapter 2. It's a great image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in a dream, and he couldn't remember what he saw, but he was going to kill all of his wise men unless they could tell him what his dream was and then interpret it. So finally they came to Daniel, and Daniel says, well, give me a minute, and I'll go pray about it. And so he did, and he came back, and he said, okay, take me to the king. I know his dream. And he proceeded to say, you saw a great, great image, and it had a head of gold. And he said, you, King Nebuchadnezzar of the Babylonians, are the head of gold. It had shoulders and arms of silver. That will be ultimately Persia, because the Babylonians would be conquered by the Persians. It had bellies and thighs of brass. The metal was getting cheaper, but it was getting harder. So gold is softer than silver and worth more. Silver is worth more and softer, though, than brass, or bronze, probably. The bellies and thigh of brass, but the legs were of iron. Well, the empire that took over from the Greeks, because it was Greece was identified, Rome was not named, was Rome, the Roman Empire. And the feet of iron and clay, the kings in the last days. But Germany, or ancient Germany, Assyria, wasn't a part of that image. And so something, well, they don't have any part in modern prophecy. Oh, yes, they do. Yes, they do. It works like this. You can read more in Daniel about the various branches of the Gentile power that will dominate the world scene at certain times in history, including the end time. It's called the beast power in the end time. It will be dominated. It'll be a coalition of a number of nations, not just one. So we have resurrections of that Roman Empire. Rome fell to the Goths and the Ostrogoths and the Heruli. They were branches of, primarily of Israelites and perhaps some Assyrians mixed in. But then they began to be restored. There was a restoration, the imperial restoration, by Justinian, who was the Eastern Emperor. Rome, by the late 400s, had already now two capitals, one in Constantinople, over by the Black Sea, and the other one was in Rome. The Roman one started to get weaker. Constantinople lasted for a very long time. But Rome was still the center. So we have the imperial restoration by Justinian, and he recognized the Pope's supremacy. So suddenly the Roman Church is elevated into a very dominant position in all the other restorations of the Roman Empire. The Frankish Kingdom, which included part of what is modern-day Germany, was done by Charlemagne in 774 AD. He was a restoration of the Roman Empire, called the Holy Roman Emperor. Then there was the Holy Roman Empire, Das Römische Himmelreich, in Germany. That was the German head, was Otto the Great in 962 AD. So we aren't even up to 1,000 yet, and we've now got it based in Germany. Then it lasted for hundreds of years in Germany, but eventually it was shifted to the Habsburg dynasty, which was an Austrian noble dynasty. And Charles V was the head in 1530 AD. So we have Germany and Austria. Napoleon was the French head. He was crowned in 1804. He didn't last anywhere near as long as the others, but he married into the Habsburg dynasty. It's part of the reason that he got it. So he was an extension of that in that sense, and he wasn't strictly French himself. He was Corsican. Ultimately, the Axis powers in modern times became another restoration with the Vatican Concordat of 1933. They became another restoration of the Roman Empire. And that would be, Hitler talked about Das Römische Himmelreich. He and Mussolini were combined, the Axis powers in Europe. There is one more yet to come, one more restoration that is yet to come. And in the prophecies referred to the beast power. So we therefore know that the modern Assyrians are going to have a major part to play in the reconstitution of a Gentile power that existed a long time, dominated by the great false church of Christianity. And with all due respects, it is false. God has a true church, very small, comparatively speaking. We will get past all this eventually. Christ will return. He will use Germany or modern Assyria as the rod of his anger to punish, frankly, a lot of the Israelite nations because of their sins. And they know better. They have a greater heritage in God's word going back. And God has his way of disciplining things. It's his call, too. Let's finish, though, on something more positive, if you would like. It's Isaiah 19. This is a prophecy of the world tomorrow. Sometimes we read this at the Feast of Tabernacles. Haven't heard it for several years, but I've had a couple of sermons where I have read it. It's in Isaiah chapter 19, and we'll begin in verse 23. And this is after the return of Christ. That's the context of this. The nations are at peace. Things have settled down after the horrendous world war that will come at the end of this age. And we're getting closer to it. Don't think that, well, there's nothing happening now. You're seeing all the preludes to it, the terrorism that's taking place. It's just a matter of time. The end is coming of this age as we know it. But there's a better age to come that will include a better time of truly converted Assyrians. That's something to rejoice in, because it also includes truly converted Israelites, includes the United States in that, and truly converted everybody else. Incredible day of the kingdom of God on earth. So in verse 23 of Isaiah 19, in that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria, and the Assyrian will come into Egypt, and the Egypt into Assyria, and the Egyptians will serve with the Assyrians. So you have those two nations working together. And in that day, now we're building up, so we have peace between the Egyptians and the Assyrians, and that's nice. And then they aren't always at peace. In fact, at the end time, there's a prophecy, the last five or six verses of Daniel 11, that what we would call from Revelation the beast power that's referred to there will overrun, as the king of the north will overrun, coming down to strike at the king of the south, and he'll go right through the glorious land because he'll come back and set up his temporary capital there, Jerusalem. But he'll go down into Egypt and destroy Egypt. So Egypt will be a primary target, although the rest will be targeted as well, especially with the way modern weapons are fired and used in these days. And when that's all over and things are better and the Egyptians and the Assyrians are serving together, not fighting together, not ganging up to fight other people together, but serving together. In that day, Israel, verse 24, Israel will be one of three with Egypt and Assyria. So you'll have Israel, Egypt, and Assyria together. A blessing in the midst of the land. Isn't that going to be incredible? After all this history, we've done a brief survey of and a little focus on the end time and the trauma of that that is coming up, that when Christ returns, these three nations won't be fighting other people and they won't be fighting each other. They will serve together. And they will be in the midst of the land a blessing, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance. So there is a great future ahead for ancient Assyria, or as we now know, modern-day Germany, as well as for the rest of Israel and Egypt, and the rest of the nations too. Thank you for joining our Bible study. We'll be doing it again in 2 weeks, and hope you'll be here for it then.